You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll preview the 2020 Democratic National Convention, which begins tonight, sort of in Milwaukee. Now, a new law set to take effect next month is meant to regulate storing and disposing of firefighting foam that contains some harmful chemical compounds known as PFAS. Except we don't have rules yet that actually define how this law should be implemented. As reported in the Wisconsin State Journal, industry groups and Republican lawmakers were able to get the Natural Resources Board to delay setting up those regulations. Chris Hubbeck covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be here.
Before we get to this law and these rules in the works, Chris, can you remind us why people are worried about these chemical compounds called PFAS?
Sure. These are a group of thousands. I think there's more than 4,000 different varieties of these compounds that are fluorinated, highly fluorinated, man-made compounds that have special properties that make them both attract and repel water, and so they make they're really good at creating surface tension, and so these give us products like Teflon and Gore-Tex and Scotchgard, and they make really good foam that can coat oil and prevent it from burning or stop it from burning. The problem is that it turns out that these chemicals are essentially impossible to destroy. They just persist in the environment and accumulate in our bodies, and they've been linked to some health problems, including cancer, reproductive system problems, immune system problems. And so we're now trying to sort of reckoning with the fact that we've filled the environment with them over the last 50 or so years.
So here we have this firefighting foam and this bipartisan law about the storage and disposal. Can you talk about the law that set up this debate over the rules that'll implement the law?
Yeah, it was a bill introduced by Senator Robert Coles, a Republican from Green Bay, and Rep. John Nygren, Republican from Marinette. Marinette being home of Tyco Fire Products, which manufactured a lot of this foam, tested it there, and has some of the worst PFAS groundwater contamination in the state, and it's been a real issue to try and clean it up. And there's a lot of people there drinking bottled water because their wells are contaminated. So the law was introduced last year. It had pretty good support from both industry groups and environmental groups. Environmental groups and the DNR both thought it didn't go far enough, but figured it was a good first step. Industry groups seemed content with it because it didn't seem to be too burdensome in terms of regulation or cost. And it was a pretty narrow in scope. It basically says you can't use firefighting foam that contains these PFAS, except in two circumstances. One, if there's an emergency, something's on fire, you can put it out, or you can test it, but only in approved facilities with approved containment and disposal techniques. The problem is the law doesn't spell out what is approved for those. And so this is a case of the devil in the details. Now it falls to the administration to come up with the particular rules to define that.
And so here's the DNR saying, okay, we'll write those rules. They did it. What did they write? And why did some of those same groups say, yeah, no, we don't like that?
So the main sticking point seems to be in the limits the law is pretty clear. It says you can't dispose of foam in a storm or sanitary sewer. You can't flush it down the drain. And the reason is that when it goes to a sewage treatment plant, they have no real way to treat it. It just cycles back into the sludge that we then spread on farm fields. And so it then finds its way back into our groundwater, into crops and the environment. But the sticking point seems to be in the numeric standards that the DNR suggested for how much PFAS can remain in the effluent or the wastewater. And they're very low, even below the proposed drinking water standards from the Department of Health Services, which the DNR is in the process of trying to establish groundwater and drinking water standards in a different rulemaking process. But so in those, you know, those recommendations are a combined 20 parts per trillion for two of the main compounds that we know the most about, PFOA and PFOS. In the rules that were proposed for this law, the limits were down around, you know, for some of these like one or two parts per trillion. And so industry groups said, whoa, wait a minute. You don't have the authority to do this for one, and two, you, where's your justification for making these super low limits, which are below even what we've recommended for drinking water?
Talking to Chris Hubbock from the Wisconsin State Journal about PFAS chemicals, a new state law regulating their use and disposal in one product, firefighting foam, and why that rulemaking process is up in the air. So what happens now, Chris? There are these objections. The DNR had to back off on these rules. So what happens next?
It's a great question. The DNR essentially said, okay, you know, fine, we'll go. We're happy to meet with whoever. We'll sit down with the industry groups. This is largely Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and a couple of other, the Food Products Association, who are sort of spearheading this. I think they're going to sit down and talk about it and maybe try and come up with some sort of compromise solution, perhaps try and come up with a more clear justification for how they got to these numeric standards, you know, basically showing their work, if you will. The issue, though, is that the law takes effect September 1. The Natural Resources Board isn't scheduled to meet again until September 22nd. So essentially, we're probably going to have a law take effect, but without a lot of the particulars defined. And so, you know, I guess that that creates some problems, potentially, for enforcement.
Now, if... So the law imposed these, you know, these guidelines, and the DNR was supposed to put these rules and set the numbers into effect. Do they? I guess there's a legal argument here. Do they have the authority to do this, or do they not, as Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce says?
It depends on who you ask. The industry groups sort of point to this 2011 law, Act 21, that in which the legislature largely tried to strip away a lot of sort of discretionary authority from the administration, and essentially says that agencies cannot create rules that aren't explicitly don't have powers that aren't explicitly given to them by the legislature. So in other words, if the legislature didn't tell them, hey, you need to set these limits at a particular place, then the groups say that this law prohibits that. This is a law that's still being fought over in the courts. Most recently, in the lawsuit against the Evers administration and Health Secretary Palm, that case had some bearing on that Act 21.
All right, a lot to watch out for over the next month, Chris. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Chris Hubbock is an energy and environment reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us today to talk about the development of rules for regulating PFAS chemicals in wastewater. Coming up, we'll find out how to protect ourselves from scams that target people seeking COVID-19 government relief funds. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get some tips on protecting yourself from scams trying to take advantage of coronavirus relief funding. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about one of his family's favorite spots at Devil's Lake.
My family likes to go camping a lot. And when I was a kid back in the 80s, one of our favorite spots was Devil's Lake. We hiked the bluffs and played games of 500 with a tennis ball at the beach. We dove into the water off a big flat boulder along the tumbled rocks trail we nicknamed the Big Kahuna. But there was a spot in the quartzite campground that blew my mind as a kid, and we called it the hill that goes up, that goes down. One weekend, our family was cruising up the middle lane of the campground on our bikes. The road up ahead appeared to rise slightly through a patch of woods. But as we made our way through the trees, we picked up speed and had to hit the brakes. That was weird. I looked back over my shoulder, and sure enough, we had just cruised up a little hill. For comment, let's go to Dan Kohlberg, my dad.
Yeah, I remember that. And we got down to the other end of the road and kind of said, wow, that was different. I mean, it looked like we were going to be going up a hill, and instead we coasted all the way here.
Back at the campsite, I remember my kid brain searching for an explanation. Was the spot enchanted by some sort of magic, magnetic, geologic, gravitational anomaly?
Regardless of what the cause is, I mean, it's like one of the seven wonders of Devil's Lake.
For the rest of the trip, my parents cooked dinner, sipped coffee, played cards, cracked peanuts. But my brother and I were back on our bikes, up, down, eyes wide and laughing. So what was really happening there? Well, when I want to know something, but I don't want to Google it, I like to ask my old friend Bob Sundling, who's always known quite a bit about quite a lot.
Hey, Bob.
Hello, Brad. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
So Bob says that if the horizon is obscured, then other visual clues like trees tell us what the lay of the land really is.
But in an area with dominant winds, if the wind's always been blowing from one direction, all trees may have grown with a slight downwind lean. And it might only be a few degrees, but it's enough that our brains are thinking, oh, that's straight.
Huh.
We tend to think we have a good inherent ability to judge up and down and horizontal and vertical, but it really depends on these external clues.
Okay, so it's not that I was just riding my bike in some wonder spot.
Probably not. I mean, it is possible, for example, that there was, say, a black hole passing through the Earth's atmosphere at that time. And I think you would have probably noticed a few other strange things happening too, like, maybe the end of the world or, you know, that type of thing.
The hill that goes up, that goes down.
Last summer, on a camping trip to Devil's Lake, my daughter and I grabbed our bikes and headed up the middle lane of the Quartzsite campground. She'd heard all about this magic spot in the trees and wanted to try it out for herself.
It was pretty weird because by the looks of it, we should have been pedaling harder than usual to go up a hill. But when we actually got to it, it was easy coasting and we just went right down, even though it looked like we were going up. The hill that goes up, that goes down.
Maybe we'll head back to Devil's Lake this summer and relive this goofy little bit of magic in our lives. It makes me grateful for this world that always seems to have a surprise waiting just up the road or down. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, with various types of coronavirus relief funding making their ways to individuals and businesses who need assistance because of the pandemic, there are also predators working to take advantage of the situation. Wisconsin's Better Business Bureau has some suggestions for what to look out for, how to protect yourself, and what to do if you think you've been contacted or victimized by a scam. Tiffany Schultz is Southwest Regional Director of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. Tiffany, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
Before we get into particular coronavirus-related scams, Tiffany, this seems like a common theme we've talked about with you over the years. When something bad happens and or when there's some kind of relief effort, we do have to be on lookout for scams, right?
Scammers follow the news, so they're always trying to be one step ahead of the consumer, and we need to be one step ahead of them. So we're warning consumers to look out for the latest scam that's going on nationwide.
What kind of things are we seeing when it comes to claims about these independent groups that can help us, you know, help us make sure we get access to government relief?
Well, right now, there's a lot of government agencies that are providing money and other support for help with the pandemic. And scammers know this. So scammers reach out to unsuspecting consumers with website searches, social media pop-up, social media communication, and they offer them as a consultant to help them through these programs, with the consumer unknowingly communicating with them and possibly giving them their personal identifiable information and or money to help them through the process, and then they don't get anything for it.
Right. Talk about what that might look like for the person looking at that text message or seeing that pop-up ad on a website.
So the consultant contacts the consumer and says, hey, I can help you get some money from these government programs, the ones that are unadvertised and the ones that are advertised. If your application was possibly denied, they can help you through it, or they have supposed access to an unadvertised program. So all the consumer has to do is fill out some paperwork, giving away their personal information to the scammer and possibly a fee for their services to get this money, and then possibly a commission on the dollar amount of money that they receive. Well, once the consumer fills out all this information and gives it back to the scammer takes off and you never hear from them again. You've never gotten your money and you've given your personal identifiable information to them through that application that you filled out for them. So they are trying to communicate with you through means of non-traditional ways that the government would never contact you that way.
What kind of red flags should we watch for, say, in terms of this group or this business we've never heard of before asking for particular kinds of information? What should we say? Wait, you want me to give you that and take a step back?
The first thing you should watch for is anybody communicating with you through the government will always have either a .gov in the website name, or they'll have a government email address. They will never reach out to you unsolicited via text, phone call, or social media means. So those are some red flags that you can really look for that might tip you off that this is a scam. Other things that you should look for is to research the programs that they are talking about. Really important. If you can't find it, it probably doesn't exist.
And I suppose if it is a project, something that does exist, we could probably search it out on our own on a government website.
Right. You're going to find all the programs that are available on the numerous government websites that are out there. If you find you hear of something that's too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. So really research those programs that this so-called consultant is talking to you about. Scammers try to make things really believable, and they try to give you just enough nuggets of information to make you feel comfortable giving them and sharing your personal identifiable information with them. But you, before you fill out any type of application form, giving out your private information, especially your social security number, you always want to do your research on the programs. And if you're communicating with somebody with a Gmail address, it's probably not real.
Now, if somebody has already done this, they've given that information and they're thinking, oh, no, I gave it to a scam group, or maybe talking to a loved one, a family member, and finding out that they've done this, who should they report that to? Is there something they should contact to find out more?
You can report that right to us at bbb.org/scamtracker. If your report is supposed to go somewhere else, we will let you know about that. But please feel free to reach out to us, report the scam, and we'll give you assistance if it needs to be directed to somebody else.
Have you gotten many reports like this, Tiffany, at the Better Business Bureau, people getting exactly these kind of COVID relief-related scams?
This is a nationwide scam alert, so it is going on in select markets throughout the United States. Locally, I haven't heard of any, which is great. We want consumers to prevent this type of scam. We don't want to hear about the scam on the other end, so we want consumers to be proactive and know what red flags to look for.
For this, or kind of any potential scam service, if we see an ad or a business reaching out, what do you recommend for us to research before we click that link or contact this maybe legit, maybe scam operation?
You should always research the company name first. research on BBB.org. Can you find a business profile on them? You want to look at the company name. You want to look at the rating, read any reviews or complaints. You can also Google the company name and then afterwards type complaints, company name review, company name rating. Get as much information on the company that you can before you try to do business with anybody, especially if they're offering something that really does sound too good to be true.
And Tiffany, something we hadn't planned to talk about, but I just talked to somebody from Iowa about the storm damage down there. And is a natural disaster like that a case, another case where scammers are going to follow the news and potentially try to rip people off just after they took this hit from a storm?
Absolutely, in many different ways. It might be shady contractors who are coming out and surveying roofs for damage that necessarily don't need any damage. It might be companies and individuals who are popping up and collecting money on behalf of certain charities or for specific funds. You always want to do your research on anything, especially if it's a natural disaster. You want to give with your head, not necessarily your heart in these situations. You want to make sure that your hard-earned money is going to the right place if you're donating to any cause.
Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Tiffany Schultz, Southwest Regional Director for the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. She gave us some suggestions for identifying and hopefully avoiding scams related to coronavirus relief funding from the government. Operations going on around the country, reaching out to people saying, we can get you that money if you give us your personal info and maybe some money up front. Coming up, the Democratic National Convention begins tonight. A little bit in Milwaukee, though it's been downsized a lot because of COVID-19. We'll find out how the pandemic has changed the nominating event and what it can mean for this year's presidential election. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, a bizarre conspiracy theory has been picking up steam in the United States over the last few years, and now one of its followers is poised to enter Congress. Kate Archer Kent and her guests look at the strange story of QAnon. That's tomorrow morning at 8 on the Ideas Network. Now, the Democratic National Convention begins tonight. While the four-day event was supposed to take place in Milwaukee this year, it's mostly moved into the digital realm because of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. This year's convention will officially name former Vice President Joe Biden as the Democratic Party nominee for president, and California Senator Kamala Harris joins him on the ticket as vice presidential candidate. Tonight, a number of big-name guests will deliver remarks, including former First Lady Michelle Obama and former presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders. Democrats aren't the only ones on the agenda. Republicans like Meg Whitman and former Ohio Governor John Kasich are making appeals to GOP voters to vote for Biden over President Trump. Ashley Koning is an assistant research professor and director of the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers University. Ashley, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks, Rob. Hi from New Jersey and hope you're staying well.
Pretty good so far, thanks. Now, how, in a normal year, how big a deal are these nominating conventions? Do they really give momentum, whatever that is, to a candidate?
You know, these conventions are typically all about pomp and circumstance. You have the rallying around the candidates. You have the live audiences. You have the cheers and applause that even viewers at home can really feel the reverberations of and connect with the candidates in that way. It's a lot of emotion. It's a lot of grandeur and celebration. And we typically see some polling bounces and bumps after these conventions. But we're in unprecedented times. And just like everything in the past several months, these conventions will be unprecedented themselves. We typically are used to, you know, these are in-person events since the dawn of conventions. So to have them not in person is such a radical shift.
So what are you watching for as we have this effectively unprecedented, mostly virtual convention?
You know, I think one of the big things to watch for is how seamlessly these conventions may go off virtually. And we still, you know, it'll be interesting, especially to see what the Trump administration decides to do and what the Trump campaign decides to do for next week. But Biden's campaign seems to really be focusing on showing responsibility and leadership by going entirely virtual. And they had been planning to go virtual for some time. So it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out and how they take that, for lack of a better word, awkwardness away by not having any type of crowd. And they're trying to fulfill it with musical segments and virtual watch parties and blending in people from all 50 states as well as the territories. So I think a big thing to watch is how well do these actually work? Are these conventions going to be a success?
We are talking about the Democratic National Convention starting tonight, a little bit in Milwaukee, mostly online. Ashley Koning is with us from Rutgers University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you going to be watching some or all of this convention? Would you have gone in person to participate, to protest? Did you visit President Trump when he showed up in the state today? What do you think of his counter-programming? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ashley, let's talk about the messaging from Democrats. A lot of polling seems to show that, you know, a substantial amount of Democratic support for Joe Biden is people wanting to cast a vote actually against President Trump. Do you think they're going to be focusing more on attack or kind of laying out their own vision?
So there is definitely an enthusiasm gap with these candidates. Those who are supporting Joe Biden are supporting him because, like you said, it is a vote against Trump instead of an enthusiastic vote for Biden himself. And, you know, even though we've seen him as vice president and as senator, America doesn't really know who Joe Biden exactly is yet. So this convention is time for him to paint that picture and for other speakers to paint that picture. But much like he's done throughout his invisible campaign, as a lot have been calling it throughout the last several months, you know, this is really a time to stick it to the current administration for the Democrats in terms of trying to rally the base against Trump, knowing that that's the motive that's been working, knowing that that's what voters want to see, and not necessarily coming out for Biden. So it could be a 1-2 punch of Democrats trying to do a little of both, trying to present the candidate in a very favorable light, and trying to get more people enthusiastic and eager to vote for Biden himself. But they know what works, clearly. And what works is, you know, they believe Trump doing what he's doing day in and day out and making voters want to vote against him.
We had this weird 2016 election where, if I recall correctly, Ashley, we had two of the, I guess, least liked presidential candidates in the history of elections running against each other. And on election day, a lot of it was people deciding which one they disliked least. Do we have any kind of repeat of that going on this time?
You know, it could be, but now Trump has a full term under his belt. And like the Biden campaign is banking on, that could be motivation. When voters get angry, and when they're frustrated, that's a huge motivation for them to turn out into the polls. And like we said, the Biden campaign can be playing into that. You know, and instead of, you know, trying to rally enthusiasm around their own candidate or around the party, it's really who he's up against. It's, you know, the lesser of two evils, as we always seem to say every election cycle. So, you know, both candidates aren't starting with a blank slate here. You know, we obviously know Biden has had a long history within politics, and now we've seen what the Trump administration has done throughout one term. So it's a slightly different scenario than it was in 2016.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous on the part of establishment third-way Democrats. The corporatist wing that runs the DNC, the old DLC crowd, that are, you know, they got Kasich speaking longer than the squad put together. So they're slapping the face of independent progressives and other people, and they're showing that they're trying to do the thing Schumer did back in 16, is to appeal to the suburban Pennsylvanians. That's what talking about then. And
John, I'm going to jump in. Thanks a lot for that call. John saying, hey, too much outreach to Republicans, including having Republicans at the convention, not enough satisfying the progressive wing of the party, Ashley.
Yeah, you know, I think this is all about strategy and very, you know, very particular strategy that they're doing here. And even Sanders himself has come out and saying, like, the number one thing is beating Trump for the party right now and worrying about progressive issues and addressing progressive issues later. And so I think it's no mistake who we see speaking and how much time we see designated to those speakers. You know, I think this is all about beating Trump and doing whatever they can to beat Trump.
Thanks a lot for that call, John, at 800-642-1234. Ashley, I know you look at polling and the latest news of what's going on. There's a fire hose of polling, national polls, battleground polls, state polls, that sort of thing. What are you watching most closely right now?
You know, I think in 2016, we saw that the national polling was pretty much on the money, and the problem came actually from the state polling. And as a state pollster myself, you know, there's a lot of issues that go on with state polling in terms of funding, the frequency, the credibility, the methodology of these state polls. And a lot of the problems and the historic errors we saw with state polling back in 2016 stemmed from states simply not having the budget, whether a center within the state or some other type of polling organization, to properly or more frequently poll states, particularly those states where we saw some stunning losses for Clinton. So I would say, you know, I'm always a fan of looking at the averages, the polling averages, and the national polls do indicate the mood of the electorate overall and some general trends. But it's really important to watch out for those state polls because we know that they're the best reflection of the Electoral College and how we actually determine who wins.
We're getting a preview of the Democratic National Convention kicking off tonight. It was supposed to be in Milwaukee. It's turned into a mostly virtual event. Ashley Koning is with us, assistant research professor and director of the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the convention? Do you have thoughts on it? Are you going to be watching it? For inspiration? Are you going to hate watch it? If you're on the other side, let us know. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the Democratic National Convention kicking off tonight. Ashley Koning is with us from Rutgers University, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions about the convention. If you've ever been to one of these things, what's it like? What are you watching for as it goes mostly virtual? Call 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, I want to give a listen and get back to something that our caller John mentioned, the presence of Republicans talking. John Kasich, former Ohio governor, Republican, he's talking in favor of Joe Biden. Here he is talking to NPR's Steve Inskeep about that.
What I'm trying to do is essentially to tell people that, you know, the party doesn't have to be your master. You can feel free to cross the aisle and vote for somebody else. That's not some terrible thing to do. In fact, if you see somebody you like and you respect, it's what being an American is all about.
So, Ashley, hearing him and other Republicans speaking in favor of Joe Biden, is there an audience for that? Is there a group that might be swayed, do you think?
You know, this election is all about winning at the margins, and it's all about turnout, right? So it's a game of turnout. We saw how much this hurt Clinton with certain voting blocks back in 2016. And we do know that there are a lot of swing voters, independent voters, voters in these battleground states that may or may not appeal to, especially, you know, John Kasich portrays himself much more as a moderate Republican. And a lot of the Biden camp has been hoping to sway what they're calling these Biden Republicans. And we've seen in polling recently that he is chipping away at that suburban vote, especially with suburban white women that are key voting blocks, frankly, that he can take away from Trump.
Let's go back to our callers. Margaret is with us in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate your guest's last comment because I grew up in an evangelical conservative Christian home. And over the course of my life and my career, have begun to identify more with the Democratic Party, but I still have strong pro-life values. And the Democratic Party continues to support very extreme abortion measures that is really isolating for individuals like me. And about a third of people who consider themselves Democrats also consider themselves to be pro-life. And I don't know if I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. I'm not voting for Trump, but I, even though I voted for Hillary Clinton last election, I don't know if I'm going to vote for him because of what the Democratic Party is, or the DNC is saying right now about abortion.
Margaret, thanks so much. Interesting perspective there. And Ashley, when it comes to politicians in either party, the, I guess, pro-life Democrats or the pro-choice Republicans, they used to exist and now they mostly don't, right? At least among the elected officials.
Right. I mean, we've seen such hyper-partisanship and polarization between the two parties there. I mean, when we look at measures of Congress, we do not see virtually any overlap in terms of ideology between Republicans and Democrats. It's a really, you know, unnerving sign of the times, for lack of a better word, for what we see in on social issues like this in terms of pro-life versus pro-choice. You know, that issue in particular is something we don't really see as one of the top issues given everything that's going on. In fact, social issues, with the exception, obviously, of racial injustice and inequality and diversity, we don't really see playing a huge part in this campaign. It really comes down to the pandemic, the protests, and the economy. But I think that's what the Biden campaign is hoping to portray with speakers like Kasich when we're talking about, you know, Biden could be for kind of the every person and appealing to different groups. And I think that's why we see the strategy of shying away from going towards the progressive wing more and trying to incorporate voters of various different backgrounds by showing things like he's very careful in his words in terms of whether, you know, not saying defunding the police, in terms of supporting fracking and, you know, when he was talking with Pennsylvanians. I think there's a very strategic method that the campaign is approaching in terms of how they're portraying him to the general public.
Thanks for that call, Margaret. We'll go now to Allison in Stoughton. Allison, hi.
Hi there. Hi. I was calling just something that your guest said a little bit ago, and I'm not sure if I heard it right, but it was something about an enthusiasm gap for Joe Biden, that it was really more a vote against Trump. And I guess where I'm going with that is I feel that, you know, I'm a progressive Democratic voter, and I supported somebody else in the primaries, but I felt there were a lot of candidates running for the nomination that I could definitely support enthusiastically. And Joe Biden is one of them. I feel that he's got the experience. He has been there before. And I feel that Trump has made a mess of things. And I feel that Joe Biden is going to have the experience to be able to fix that, even if he's not the most progressive candidate. I'm just wondering, as the other Democrats I know also are enthusiastic about him, and I was wondering if there is certain data that you have that's saying that people are just voting against Trump, or did I misunderstand that?
Allison, thanks for the call. Ashley?
So I think we've actually seen some studies, including one by Pew Research Center, that have come out recently talking about this enthusiasm gap, and those who are voting for Trump are much more enthusiastic about Trump and voting for Trump as opposed to voting against Biden than Biden supporters are the other way around. So in other words, Biden supporters are more so voting against Trump by voting for Biden and are less enthusiastic. So that's been emerging in a lot of the polling recently, despite Biden's large lead in a lot of polls with Trump. And you know, I think that's the interesting thing about polling, that we know on an anecdotal level, and I get this all the time, we poll statewide in New Jersey, we know on an anecdotal level from various people, oh, well, I feel this way, I don't understand how anybody could support that person, or how anybody else could feel the other way. But when we look at polling overall, it shows us the patterns and trends of everybody, because polling is supposed to statistically represent whatever population it's analyzing. So if we're analyzing the general population or the population of Joe Biden voters, you know, we may get a different picture than what somebody knows or experiences anecdotally. But that's also why it's important for us to look and break things down by certain demographics to see where trends go and how they match up to the overall base or population that we're looking at and how they may differ.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate it.
Ashley Koning is an assistant research professor and director of the Eagleton Center for Public Interest Polling at Rutgers University. She joined us today to talk about the Democratic National Convention. It starts this evening at 8 p.m. This was supposed to be the week when tens of thousands of people arrived in Milwaukee for the Democratic National Convention, but the city's hopes of a monumental summer were dashed by the coronavirus. Major sporting events and festivals have also been canceled. And as Corrine Hess reports, the city's momentum has been stalled.
2020 didn't turn out like anyone expected, but for the city of Milwaukee, the list of disappointments is long. It's not just the DNC. Major sporting events have been moved or delayed. Staples, like Summerfest, were canceled. And at the Wisconsin State Fairgrounds, people have been reduced to waiting hours in line for takeout fried food and cream puffs.
There's the first order, and I'll be second.
Bob and Carrie Gundrum are there. They attended the fair every year.
We were looking around here wondering, with the weather it's been, it would have been an amazing attendance down here. We love coming every year. It's one of the highlights of our summer. It's just awful that this place is empty right now.
It's hard to overstate just how devastating the summer has been for Milwaukee, especially with the loss of a full-scale Democratic National Convention. 50,000 people were expected to visit Milwaukee, including 15,000 media from around the world. The event was also expected to generate $200 million. Now it will be almost entirely virtual. National speakers won't travel here. Vice President Joe Biden is accepting the party's nomination in Delaware. Local politicians like Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett will speak in person, but to an empty arena. For Barrett, who has been mayor since 2004, the changes were disappointing, both personally and professionally.
Because I wanted to show off our city. I wanted the world to know Milwaukee's story. I wanted local businesses to enjoy an economic boost, and obviously those opportunities are not going to occur.
This was supposed to be a showcase summer for the Fiserv Forum that opened 2 years ago, for all the new restaurants that have opened downtown, for the city's growing skyline, and now the arena is mostly deserted. The Milwaukee Bucks were favorites to win their first national championship since 1971. They could have been hosting the NBA Finals this summer. Instead, they're playing a delayed season in Orlando. Next month, Kohler, just north of Milwaukee, would have hosted the Ryder Cup, drawing national golf enthusiasts. It got postponed until next year. Alex Lazary is a senior vice president of the Milwaukee Bucks and was instrumental in helping Milwaukee land the DNC. He says the Democrats made the right call not to come to Milwaukee, but the outcome isn't good for the city.
The reason this was such a big opportunity is because, you know, these type of summers and years don't come around very often. Bucks, deep playoff run, convention, state fair, Summerfest, Ryder Cup, having all of that coming within a 3 or 4 month span.
Lazary grew up in New York. He moved to Milwaukee having never been to the city after his father Mark purchased the Bucks in 2014. He says he wants people to know Milwaukee can compete with cities like Houston, Miami, Austin, Denver, and Chicago.
By winning the bid, that's what we were able to show. And I hope that it continues to allow us to be ambitious as a city.
What's left of the DNC will now take place at the Wisconsin Center, a downtown convention center that's much smaller than the Fiserv Forum. Marty Brooks heads the center. He says he hopes the city's leaders aren't soured on going after national events in the future.
We've handled this as best as any city could have in regards to all the changes that have been thrown at us in the past couple of months. I have lived in places where the cities had this, oh, poor us mentality, and that becomes very destructive.
Residents are doing the best they can. At State Fair Park, cars are lined up around the Milwaukee Mile Speedway with people waiting for takeout fair food. People hope that next summer is better, but this summer has left a mark. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, does every emergency call need a police response? We'll find out how some communities around the country are changing their emergency response systems and bringing more mental health care into the mix. The U.S. Postal Service is seeing cuts in its operations just as it gears up for one of its biggest challenges with a big jump in voting by mail. We'll look at the politics behind the post office and what's at stake in November. And extended family households are getting more common in the U.S., especially during the pandemic. Our guest tells us why generations of family members are sharing households, and maybe you could share your story. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, what does it take to create a highway? Kate talks to an engineer about the challenges of highway construction and design. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk with a guest who studied corruption firsthand around the world and who says the problem is getting worse here at home. We'll take a look at her new book, On Corruption in America. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.